To those of you listening to the recording who weren't able to make it to class today, I did hand back the quiz, and what we're going to do first is to go over the answers to the quiz. I'll read out the questions, so in case you were listening but you weren't able to pick up your quiz, at least you can hear what the questions were. So first question says this, an atom can be split up into three types of smaller subatomic particles. Name the three types of subatomic particles, state where each particle is located within the atom, and state the charge of each particle. Then the next part of the question says, explain how one of the subatomic particles is related to the term element. So I think some of you got caught off guard that there was more than one thing asked for in the question, because one thing I noticed in a lot of your answers is that especially the last part, it seemed like you might have missed the fact that there was more than one question. So I try to make it clear what the question asks for by putting things in bold to make sure that you see the things that you need to answer. Sometimes there's things in underlining or italics to try to highlight what you're supposed to answer. So for the exam, just watch out that there might be more than one thing I ask for within one question. So if I wanted to make a diagram, even though this is not the most accurate picture of what an atom looks like, I think this is what I might have done in the notes originally. And there's three types of particles that are involved. This is not a particle, but there is the nucleus of the atom. Oh, sorry. There we go. Which is the center of the atom. There are two types of particles located within the nucleus. So there are protons, which are the positively charged particles. And then there are neutrons, which have no charge. In the atom but outside of the nucleus, we then have the electrons, which are negatively charged particles. So as far as which one of these is related to the term element, the most directly related is proton, because which element the periodic table that we have is related to how many protons that element has. So an element is identified by how many protons it has. Does anyone have any questions on this first question? All right, moving on. Explain the difference between the terms substance, compound, and molecule. And as part of your explanation, you were supposed to state an example of a compound that's not a molecule and also a molecule that's not a compound. So for question two, a substance is matter that has a consistent formula throughout. And I should say here, this is the quiz one answers. So the substance, it could be just an element. So gold, for example, is a substance. A substance could be something that has multiple elements in it, which that leads us to our definition of compound. So a compound is a substance composed of two or more elements. So a compound is not just the number of atoms it has, but it's the fact that it's got more than one type of element to it. So back to the term substance, substance might be compounds, or substance might just be an individual element. A molecule, that has to do with how the atoms are connected. And we might have a little bit better picture of a molecule now that we've started talking about ionic versus covalent bonding. So a molecule is a set of atoms that are bound together. And so more specifically, it would be a set of atoms connected through covalent bonds. We didn't have the term covalent back in the quiz, so you didn't have to put that in. But now that we know the different types of bonds, a molecule is something held together by covalent bonds. Now, as far as something that is a compound but not a molecule, the main example that you had gotten in class is sodium chloride. If you can recall me talking about the format of what sodium chloride looks like, it's a set of ions that are just attracted to each other. And I think I might have even shown you a picture of a sodium chloride crystal to show something that is cubic in shape. So in something like sodium chloride, all the ions are held together because of the fact that you have positive and negative charges attracting each other, but you don't have covalent bonds. So it's a compound because it's got more than one element in it, but it's not a molecule because it doesn't have covalent bonds. So one of the common answers I saw is water. Water is a compound, yes, because it's made up of oxygen and hydrogen, but water does exist as molecules because for each oxygen, you have two hydrogens that are directly connected to it. Now, what about something that is a molecule but not a compound? So a good example of that would be something like oxygen or hydrogen. Those are elements that exist naturally in the form of molecules, but these are not compounds because it's just a single kind of element. So any questions on that problem? Moving on to number three, then. And some of this part of three might have sounded similar to the previous question because you're asked to explain the difference between the terms compound and mixture, and then you're asked to describe the difference between a homogeneous and a heterogeneous mixture, where you are also asked to give an example of a homogeneous mixture and a heterogeneous mixture. So we already have the definition of compound up above here. That's a substance that's composed of two or more elements. And so a mixture is a combination of two or more substances. So again, it could be just individual elements. It could be compounds. But it's the fact that it's two different types of material mixed together that makes it a mixture, whereas a compound is just a single substance which has multiple elements as part of it. A homogeneous mixture There's a couple of different ways of describing it. One is that it has a consistent composition throughout, which makes it sound a little bit like the definition of a substance. But remember, a substance is a single formula. It's a single type of material all the way throughout. A homogeneous mixture is multiple substances put together, but that composition of substances would be consistent throughout. Another way of saying that is that the components are not easily separated. And the example that I had given in class for a homogeneous mixture is something like salt water. You put salt into water, you're not going to be able to tell the one from the other unless you do something to it, which specifically you could boil off the water, leave behind the salt. But that means that you have to go through some kind of process like that to separate the two out. they're otherwise not easily separable. So a heterogeneous mixture that's one where the composition is not the same throughout. So we could say variable composition throughout. And it's one where the components are easily separable. In class, I'd given the example of sand and water. Some of you might have the practical experience that if you've gone to the beach, tried to make a sand castle, you might be able to mix the sand up in water, and temporarily it looks like it all mixes together, but you just wait a short amount of time and the two automatically will separate out. Very common answer I got on the quiz was oil and water. Oil will normally float on water, and again, you might be able to mix them together temporarily, but then over time they're going to separate out from each other. Questions on that problem? Yes. Depends on what kind. So if you have raw milk, if you leave it sitting out, you'll have the cream that separates out from the rest of the milk. So that would be considered a heterogeneous mixture. Now, next question. You're asked to state the standard metric unit for each one of these types of measurements. So we had length, volume, mass, temperature, and time. So for length, the standard is the meter, which if you said centimeters or millimeters or some other form of meter, you got partial credit because, yes, we use those measurements. But as far as what the standard unit is supposed to be, that's just the plain meter itself. For volume, that would be the liter. So again, if you said milliliters or centiliters, you got partial credit for that one. For mass, I know this sounds strange, but it is the kilogram that is considered the standard unit. Yes, we can measure in just grams, but formally, when we're talking about the standard metric units, it's the kilogram. For temperature, we did talk about different temperature scales, and yes, in lab, it's normally the Celsius scale that we use, but the official scale for the metric system is Kelvin. In fact, Celsius is just the same thing as Kelvin, but with a different 0 point. If you take Kelvin and add 273, you get Celsius. But that means that Kelvin's really the underlying scale. And then as far as time, it's the second. So again, if you gave some variation of some of these units, then you were given partial credit for it. Now the next one, that one seemed to give, as a class, the most difficulty. You were given several different quantities of grams, but with using the metric prefixes. So you were supposed to rewrite each of these different quantities to be just grams. So let's do each one of these. The first one was 250 mg. M means milli, which means 10 to the negative 3. So one way you could have written the answer is just to say 250 times 10 to the negative 3. Some of you tried to use these powers, but maybe it's been a while since you've had to do exponents. So you don't just say 250 to the negative 3. You'd have to put that 10 in there to say that it's 10 to the negative 3. The other way you could have done it is if we have the decimal point after the 250, 10 to negative 3 means you move the decimal point 3 places to the left. And so that ends up being the number 0.250 grams. Some of you that do know your exponents, you might have even written it like this. You might have said 2.5 times 10 to the negative 1. That also would be a right answer. That's where you're multiplying out the 250 by that power of 10. Moving to the next one. We have 58 micrograms. So that symbol, that's a mu, stands for micro, and that's 10 to the negative 6. So we're going to need some extra zeros here. But if we take 58 and we have 10 to negative 6, that means we're going to move our decimal point 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 places to the left. So we get 0.00058 grams. Again, some of you did use exponential notation. So you could have said 58 times 10 to negative 6. Or I think there were some people that said 5.8 times 10 to the negative 5. Any of those three ways would have been fine. For the next one, that was 73.4 kg. K is kilo, which means 1,000, 10 to the 3. So if you had to multiply by 1,000, that means we're going to move the decimal point the other direction. We'll move it three places to the right. And so we get the number 73,400. In terms of powers of 10, that could have been 73.4 times 10 to the 3, or 7.34 times 10 to the 4. The next one was 6.19 cg. C means centi, which is 10 to the negative 2. So if it's 10 to the negative 2, that means we're going to move our decimal point two places to the left, and so we get 0.0619. And all of these, I should be saying grams. So in powers of 10, it's 6.19 times 10 to the negative 2. Then the last one, 420 ng. N stands for nano, which is 10 to the negative 9. So, again, we need a bunch of zeros here. So if we have 10 to the negative 9, then we're going to move 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 places to the left. So there's 6 zeros in front of it. 0.00000420. Doing powers of 10, it's 420 times 10 to the negative 9, or 4.2 times 10 to the negative 7. So does anyone have any questions how I came up with any of those numbers? Okay, moving on to the next question. Number 6. That one says, explain the difference between an intensive physical property and an extensive physical property, and state an example of each property. So intensive property is a property that does depend on the amount of a substance. That does not depend. Almost got it backwards. So it's a property that does not depend on the amount of a substance. And two of the most popular answers in terms of examples were density and temperature. If you have water that comes out of the tap, it doesn't matter if you fill up a small glass or a large glass, it would be at the same temperature. And just like we had seen in lab in your measurements, no matter how much water that you might have, that ratio of mass to volume, which is the density, ends up being something that's constant. So the opposite is the extensive property, which is a property that does. Depend on the amount of substance. And so there were several popular answers there. Mass or volume. I remember one answer that was kind of given in sentence form, where if you had to heat something up, then how much energy would take to heat would depend on how much of that substance you would have. And so, yes, that's a description of an extensive property as well. Moving to the next one. You were told that the density of the compound limonene, which is something that gives citrus its fragrance and its taste, you were told that the density is 0.841 grams per milliliter, and you were asked for the amount of mass that was in 12 milliliters of limonene. So to work the problem, this was indirectly a problem of unit analysis. If you remember what I had said in class, whenever we're mixing our units, if we're looking for a particular kind of unit, in this case grams, because that's mass, we have to do something to get milliliters to cancel out. Well, if you take the formula of density being mass divided by volume, then we can rewrite that formula. We could say that if we multiply both sides by V, we get density times volume is equal to mass. And we do exactly that if we take the 0.841 grams per milliliter and we multiply it by milliliters, well, the milliliters are going to cancel out. And that'll leave us with just grams, which I've suddenly forgot the number. Let me just do that real quick. It would be, if we don't care about sig figs, which I didn't at all for the quiz, 10.092 grams. Now, next problem seemed to cause some confusion. You were asked to calculate how many moles of water there were in 20 grams of water. So it's true that a mole is a number. And so some of you tried to use the number 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. That's, though, if I was asking how many molecules of water there were. Which, that's not the question was asked. The question was how many moles. So if the whole point of that mole discussion is this. If we look at the periodic table and we look at the numbers underneath the elements, that tells you the mass of that particular element. And if we're doing it in terms of individual atoms, you might remember we have this atomic mass unit. But if we're talking about moles of atoms, then that same number on the table is in grams. And so what we needed to do to answer this question is to come up with what is the mass of one mole of water, which that's called the molar mass. So if we look at the formula of water, there's one oxygen and two hydrogens. So it would be one times whatever the mass of oxygen is, plus two times whatever the mass of hydrogen was. So if you look on the periodic table, oxygen is 15.9994, which, yes, it's okay if you rounded a bit and said 16.0. For hydrogen, it's 1.0079, which, again, yes, it was okay if you rounded a little bit and said 1.01. So you put the two together, and I'm going to get 18.02 grams of water for every mole. So then how am I going to turn this grams of water into moles? Well, if I divide by its molar mass. The other way to say it is multiply by 1 over the molar mass. Why? Because if I have grams per mole in the bottom here, well, then grams is going to cancel out with grams. And if I have 1 over moles, then that's going to give me moles as my unit. So 20 divided by 18 is 1.11. So the answer was 1.11 moles. Got just a couple more questions here. Question 9 said, define the term isotope and then explain the difference between the terms mass number and atomic number and say which value changes as you go between isotopes. So let's do the mass number and atomic number first. Atomic number is the number of protons. On the periodic table, yes, it's the number on this table that's up above. But what is that number? It's the number of protons. Question. Oh, sorry. There we go. So remember, it's the number of protons that tell you what kind of element that you have. Now, what's the mass number? So this one, I can understand why it gets confusing, because you have the term mass, but then we stick this word number on it. And a mass number is not the actual mass of the atom. So some of you thought it was the number that's below the element on the periodic table. So that's another thing, which is atomic mass, the real mass of the atom. But the mass number is a counting number, which that's equal to the number of protons plus the number of neutrons. So in other words, the mass number is something that says what's in the nucleus. So then what is an isotope? Or what are isotopes? Those are atoms of the same element with different numbers of neutrons. That automatically means we have the same number of protons. Because if it's part of the same element, an element by definition has a certain number of protons. So isotopes, if they're part of the same element, they have the same number of protons. What makes them different is the number of neutrons. So that means that the mass number, that combination of protons and neutrons, is different between isotopes. But again, since isotopes are the same atom, they're going to have the same atomic number. Now, last question that I graded was to explain the difference between the law of definite proportions and law of multiple proportions. So that came up during our discussion of atomic theory. And so for definite proportions, that's the idea that a single substance will have a constant or fixed ratio of the elements in the substance. Unless the substance is just a single element, in which it's 100%. But it's a fixed ratio of elements in a single substance. So what is the law of multiple proportions? Well, that's that different elements can combine in different ratios. In order to produce different substances. So the example I probably gave in class is that water, that's a combination of hydrogen where you have two hydrogens per oxygen. But there's also hydrogen peroxide, which is H2O2. Two oxygens that have two hydrogens connected. So that's an example of the law of multiple proportions. The same element can combine in different ways with different numbers to come up with different substances. Now, the last question on the quiz I ended up throwing out because, as I said before class started, I felt that maybe I should have done some more review of that topic before putting it on the quiz. So let me read out the question, though. The question says that the Bohr model of an atom was an important discovery that led to the modern theory of atomic structure. Describe the Bohr atomic number or model and explain the experiments or observations that led to the creation of this model. So the model itself is that you have electrons that are in fixed orbits around the atom. They're at specific distances from the atom. And that's different than older models that didn't make any restriction or didn't specify where electrons were. An older model, the atom just said, well, you got protons, you got electrons, but there was no concept of where they were located relative to each other. So the Bohr model was an advancement because it said, no, electrons exist in these fixed places. And the way that idea came about is the way that different substances interact with light, or the way that different substances release light. And so we had had a discussion in class about how a substance will absorb only very specific frequencies of light, or would only release specific frequencies of light. And the idea behind that is that as electrons absorb energy, they move from close to the nucleus to further away, and when those electrons fall back down, they'll release light again. But it's the fact that there's only specific frequencies involved that led to the idea that electrons only exist specific places around the nucleus. And that's what the Bohr model is. So now, for the recording's sake, or for those of you who weren't here right at the beginning, let me just make some comments about the quiz. The style of questions on the quiz will be very similar to the style of questions on the exam. So a lot of it is very definition-based, although the material we've been doing more recently has some more problem type of material, specifically in naming compounds. And to name a compound, you have to be able to identify different types of ions. If you are given different elements on the periodic table, you need to be able to identify what charges they might be. So that's not as much definition-based. But there's still a lot of material that's definition-based. And so it'll be very direct types of questions. Most of these questions weren't really asking anything obscure. They weren't anything really far off the topic. It was pretty much related to what was presented in lecture. And so that's exactly the same type of style that you're going to expect on the exam. Yes, the exam may cover some of these same topics that were on the quiz, but there is the new material that we've done since the quiz as well. So again, later on today, once we've wrapped up with the chapters, then I'll review the topics that are going to be on the exam. If you didn't do well on the quiz, then there's a couple of different situations I might think possible. One is that maybe you didn't expect these kinds of questions. Maybe you were expecting something more similar to what you might have in a multiple choice type of exam. And maybe it caught you off guard that you had to actually cough up the information yourself. Well, now you've got an idea of the types of things that you need to study, the types of things that you'll need to be responsible for. So if it was that you got caught off by the type of quiz, now you have a better idea what's going to be on the exam. And again, for the recording's sake, or for those of you who aren't here to hear this, if you didn't do well in your first quiz, your quiz does not determine your entire grade. I mean, yes, obviously it's some percentage of your grade, but you do have a bunch of assignments left. And so I don't want you to be too discouraged by just receiving one bad grade. Now, another scenario of why might you have not ended up with a good grade? Well, I'm worried whether some of you might have put the effort into studying or not. I can't tell that directly from your quizzes, but there are some of the questions I thought were easier than others, but there were a lot of the questions that as a class were missed. And so you have to ask yourself, did you put the time in that's necessary really to learn the material? Maybe you were thinking this was going to be an easier quiz than it was. So if you underestimated how much you needed to study, well, then now you know what you need to be doing over the weekend in order to prepare for the exam. Let's say you really did study. You put a lot of time and effort in, and you didn't get the grade that you wanted. Well, then really you should try to come by office hours today if you can, or tomorrow if today's office hours don't work, or I can even stay after class for a few minutes before I run off to grab lunch, because that's what I normally do between class and office hours, is just to go grab some lunch, bring it back to my office. So if office hours time won't work, let me know so I can work with you for a few minutes after class. If you did try to study and you're struggling and you're not sure what to do, there are a few things I could recommend. One is for the vocabulary terms, for things like law of definite proportion, law of multiple proportion, flashcards might be a good way for you to go. If you've ever learned a foreign language, you might have done something like that before to learn your vocabulary, and this is another foreign language, the language of chemistry. So you might try flashcards if you hadn't tried anything else. One thing might be that I don't require you to turn in the homework. Maybe you're more used to some structure where there's always this pressure to get work done, to keep you on task. And so maybe not having that constant pressure makes you a little bit less likely to do some of the problems. But I really did come up with that list of problems in order to give you an idea of the types of things to be working on. And I know that maybe there are other instructors that really insist on turning in the homework. But I really believe in you having your own self-discipline, because when you do graduate, when you get out and get a job, you might not have that external pressure always on you, other than the threat that you might lose your job if you don't do what you're supposed to be doing. So you won't always have an instructor or a parent or someone pressuring you. You got to have your own self-discipline. And so that's why I don't require homework to be turned in, because I'm trying to model what you're really going to be expected to do a little bit later on in life. Back to studying techniques. If you haven't been reading the textbook, you really need to read. Even if the lectures end up making sense, even if I happen to say something in a good way, the act of sitting down and making yourself read, that's another way to absorb information that's different than listen to some guy get up and talk for a few hours. What if you're having trouble holding on to that information? Then try to explain it to someone else. Now, some people don't do as well in study groups because you end up socializing more than you end up studying. But it doesn't have to be a study group. It could be just some other friend. It could be a relative, your brother or sister that you're saying, hey, let me try to explain this thing to you because I got to go tell my teacher this. So you take some concept like isotope. You're trying to think, well, what's an isotope? Well, close the book and try to get up and say to somebody, well, what's an isotope? If you can't even get one word out because you don't remember what it is, well, then you know right there what it is you've got to go back and look up. And let's say you start to say that isotopes got different something, and you don't remember what that something is. Then you know what to go back and to read. So these are just a small number of ways that I might recommend that you study. But like I said, if you did try to put the effort in and you didn't get the results you wanted, then come talk to me. Because maybe you could tell I'm not that instructor that's going to yell at you for not knowing something. I want you to try to learn. And if you're having trouble, I'm going to see what I can do to try to help you. The last thing I'll say is if you did have concerns, like you think I misgraded something, then after class, just let me know. There's plenty of time left till the end of the quarter, so if I've made an honest grading mistake, then let me know so that I can fix it. Also, you might just double check, because I tend to do it in my head, that I added up the numbers correctly. I tend to be a little quicker these days than using a calculator if I do it in my head, but I'd make mistakes because I'm not a calculator. So just do double check that I had added up things correctly. And let me just... Last class, I started to talk about shapes of molecules. And so let me just review what the logic is behind coming up with the shape of a molecule. It's the idea that atoms can have different types of pairs of electrons around them. And there's two different types of pairs of electrons. There's bonding pairs, those pairs of electrons that are going to end up in covalent bonds. And then there's the ones that aren't involved in bonding, and those are what are known as lone pairs. And so we had seen a handful of shapes, some of which are fairly logical why they end up the shapes that they do. So just to review some of that very quickly, we saw the substance beryllium hydride that only has two bonds in it. And I tried to describe what this acronym VSEPR stands for, which, just to write it out one last time, it's valence shell electron pair repulsion. So it's the electrons that are in the valence shell that are the ones that participate in bonding. That's why we only look at the valence electrons, and that's why we had learned electron configurations, to understand that there are different shells of electrons and that we're focusing just on the valence shell. Electrons do tend to show up in pairs. The one exception is we did talk about the fact there are things called radicals, which is where you can end up with unpaired individual electrons. But most of the time, and I'll just tell you this, for any of the examples I put on the exam, everything's going to end up in pairs. I'm going to stick to easier examples. So if you have pairs of electrons, those are like charges, and so they're going to repel each other. And so for this beryllium hydride that's only got two bonds, well, if you have the two bonds 180 degrees from each other in three-dimensional space, that's as far apart as you can get them from each other. Because if the angle gets smaller in any direction, then that means they're closer to each other, so they're going to feel that repulsion. So it's when you're at 180 that you've got the most space between the electrons. So that angle was 180, and we have shape names for each of these situations, and this one is called linear because it's a line. So to review some of the other shapes just quickly, we had borane, which had three bonds in it, no other pairs of electrons in the valence shell. Well, if you got three objects trying to get as far apart from each other as you can, then that ends up being a 120-degree angle. And you might remember telling you that it's not a triangle, but it's got this three-fold symmetry. So the buzzword for that is trigonal. But we already saw two different trigonal shapes. So this one's a flat shape, which means it's in a plane, which is why it's called trigonal planar. And then we got three other shapes that are all very related to each other. They're all almost exactly the same bond angle as each other. And that would be if we had four bonds, or more generally, four pairs of electrons. So here are the three shapes that are all related to each other. If you have four bonds, or three bonds and one lone pair, or the last case would be something like water, where it has two pairs of electrons and just two bonds. So the magic number for this first of these shapes was 109.5, which there's no easy way to come up with that number. These first two shapes, we take a circle, cut it in half, that's how we get 180. Take a circle, cut it in thirds, that's how we get 120. This last one, though, is a three-dimensional shape. The main point I want to make is it's not 90 degrees. Because if you look at four bonds and you got them in the format of a cross shape, well, you might think that it would be 90 degrees. But that's if we only limit the atoms to being in the plane of the paper itself. But real-life molecules can be 3D. So that's why we end up with this oddball angle, because it's not just some flat structure. The name for this structure was tetrahedral, which that's a geometrical term, meaning it's a four-sided shape where all sides, all angles of that shape are exactly equal, which is exactly what we're going to get with a molecule like methane, CH4. Now, the last shape we got to the other day was this next one, which it's no longer a perfect pyramid. And that's because we've got this lone pair here. And that lone pair effectively occupies a bit more space than a bonding pair, or has a little bit more repulsion at least. And that's because for these bonding pairs, you've got nuclei at either end of the bond, because they're two different atoms. But if you only have the lone pair, then you've only got a nucleus on one side, there's nothing on the other here. So that's why this pair of electrons ends up having more repulsion. So this angle is less than 109.5. Technically, it's about 107. So if one pair caused the other atoms to be squished a little bit more closely to each other, then if you have two lone pairs, it's even more squished together. So I'll just say it this way, that it's even more less, it's even smaller than 109.5. It's actually about 105. But you know, 105 versus 107 versus 109, that's not a huge difference in shape. So it's a small distortion that you end up getting. So I don't think I wrote it down. For this one that's for ammonia, that shape was called trigonal planar. No, sorry. That's the previous one. Trigonal pyramidal. Because it is in the shape of a pyramid. It's like a three-sided base pyramid. But it's no longer completely equal in shape. That's why it's not called a tetrahedron. This last shape name is pretty simple. It's bent. Because you've only got two bonds, so you don't have any kind of pyramid. And it's not a line, so we can't call it linear. So the best name for it is bent. So these are the five shapes that you need to be familiar with. Does anyone have any questions about Vesper theory? Yes.
Yeah.
It's the minimum repulsion. All of these shapes are trying to minimize the repulsion, because if you have repulsion, that's higher energy. And just like the proverbial whatever goes up comes back down, molecules are trying to get to low energy. So they want to keep the bonds as far away as they can to make that repulsion as little as possible. Yeah. No, I'm for the exam, to try to take it a little easier, I'll say no, you don't have to memorize the angles. You do need to just know the shape names. I'll say this much. You should know that the trigonal pyramidal, it's a smaller angle than tetrahedral, because I want you to know that lone pair does distort or squish together that geometry, but you don't have to memorize the numbers. Yeah. I did last time, but I'll go ahead and write it in the notes again this time. Lone pairs effectively cause more repulsion than bonding pairs. So lone pairs will cause a small change in geometry. Now, there are other shapes out there. So if you go online for any of your studying, you'll find there are several other types of shapes. But those are for molecules that have even a greater number of atoms around the center. And in this course, we don't tend to tackle those kinds of cases. So that's why your text and even these notes here only have the five shapes that we've discussed. Yes? You mean the Bohr model?
No, like right before this,
I think it is. Oh, so if you look at the notes from Tuesday, I took the phrase Vesper and I wrote out each part of that phrase to explain what it means. And what I was talking about was repulsion. That if the bonds are, or pairs of electrons are closer to each other, that causes higher energy because you have negative charge bumping into negative charge. And so the molecules have their electrons spread out as much as possible in order to reduce that repulsion, in order to lower the energy of the system. Any other questions on Vesper theory? Then let's go ahead and take our break. Since we've just finished talking about shape names and types of shapes, I want to talk about one of the practical consequences of what the shape of a molecule is, and that's something known as the molecule's polarity. So the term polar means to have one area of the molecule that's more positively charged, one area of the molecule that's more negatively charged. And we could refer to that as the positive pole and the negative pole. So I know that many of you have not had physics before, but you might have heard of North Pole and South Pole, which doesn't just mean a physical location on the planet. It also means a direction that a magnetic field points. And so we're going to limit our discussion, though, to just talking about charge. So polar means to have an imbalance of charge across the molecule. Or even it doesn't have to be about molecules, it could be bonds. So I'll say polar means has an imbalance in charge. Which another way to express that means has a positive end and a negative end. So what causes these imbalances of charge? Well, it all comes back to this concept of electronegativity. So remember that when we talked about ionic bonds versus covalent bonds, that I said that it's this property of the atoms, electronegativity, that causes them to form different types of bonds. So for example, in water, you've got hydrogen and oxygen, which are on opposite sides of the periodic table. And we've discussed a couple of times now how elements at opposite sides of the periodic table tend to behave differently from each other. The ones on the right-hand side like to gain electrons. The ones on the left-hand side like to lose electrons. And that influences the way they behave once you bond them together. So if you put oxygen and hydrogen in a bond, first of all, this is kind of an exception to what normally happens. Normally, I said that if you have things from opposite sides of the periodic table, they tend to make ionic bonds. But it turns out that hydrogen's a little different. And so when hydrogen connects to oxygen, it does make a covalent bond, but it makes an imbalanced bond because oxygen is much more electronegative than hydrogen is. And so that means there ends up being a partial negative charge on oxygen because oxygen's pulling on that bond and bringing some of the electrons closer to it. Well, if it's pulling it away from hydrogen, that means hydrogen is a little bit positively charged. And that's exactly what the term polar means. You've got this imbalance of charge, one end more negative, one end more positive. So a bond becomes polar when there's a difference in the electronegativity of the atoms in the bond. So if we had something like hydrogen, hydrogen will form a molecule all on its own. You have two H's that are connected together. Well, since they're the same atom, they have the same tendency to pull on the electrons. They have the same electronegativity. So since there's no difference in electronegativity, that means the bond in hydrogen is non-polar. It's not polar. So the bond in H2 is nonpolar. That's the way the term is expressed. It's nonpolar because there is no difference in electronegativity. Now, I've focused on bonds. What about molecules? Well, there the situation's a little bit more complicated. So if you have something like this, carbon connected to four different fluorines. Fluorine is the most electronegative element, by far. It really likes to pull onto electrons. And so if you put a fluorine connected to carbon, that bond is going to have a dipole. But it turns out that this molecule, CF4, the molecule itself is nonpolar. Now, why would that be? It's because of its shape. That's partly why we care about these different types of shapes. And that's because the bonds in this are exactly equally spaced out from each other. And so the effect that one bond has on the molecule is exactly canceled out by all the other bonds. They're all exactly balanced with each other. Now, this is a more complicated example to understand. We could take a simpler molecule like beryllium hydride. In fact, let me write that down and I'll come back to this other one. So hydrogen and beryllium, there is a difference in electronegativity. But this example is easier to understand because you can imagine a tug of war where you have two teams that are equally strong as each other. So just in case if English is not your primary language, you've never heard of a tug of war, you've probably seen this type of thing before. Imagine two teams that are holding onto a rope and the two teams are pulling the rope opposite directions, trying to make one team move one direction or the other. Well, if you got two teams that are equally matched, nobody's going to go anywhere. And that's what happens in a molecule like beryllium hydride. Even though beryllium and hydrogen are different electronegativity, their bonds are exactly balanced with each other. So it's like that case of two teams pulling with equal strength. And so the bonds end up canceling each other out, and so the molecule as a whole is nonpolar. That it ends up being exactly the same case in this tetrahedral shape. Maybe it's not as easy to visualize because you've got things sticking out in different directions. But remember, the tetrahedral means that it's exactly symmetric shape, that all the angles, all the sides are equal. And so this ends up being balanced as well. The same thing ends up being true in a molecule like BCl3. Boron and chlorine have different electronegativities. But in a triangular shape, a triangle is an exactly symmetric shape. So in all three of these cases, even though the molecules might have polar bonds, because the bonds are exactly balanced with each other, they cancel each other out, and the molecule as a whole ends up nonpolar. Let me write down exactly what I just said. In these three cases, even though the bonds may be polar, and I'm going to emphasize, even though the bonds may be polar, because the molecules are symmetric, the bonds are exactly balanced with each other, so the polarity of the individual bonds is canceled out. Making the molecule as a whole nonpolar. Then let me emphasize, making the molecule as a whole nonpolar. Now, what about something like water? It ends up being a really polar substance, which has several different effects. So one thing we could talk about is the fact that water, when it freezes, it expands. Some of you might have encountered this. If you ever taken a glass bottle, put it in the freezer, and it was something filled with water or something that was mainly water, you might have experienced the fact that you come back later, that glass bottle is broken. And why? Because when water freezes, it expands out. That is different, though, than most substances that are out there. Most things, when they freeze, they contract inwards. They get smaller. So why is it that water gets larger? Because water is so polar that when it freezes, the molecules pull themselves into a particular shape. In fact, let me just draw that out really quickly. Oops. Yes, there we go. So you end up with these interactions between water molecules that end up making these hexagon shapes that form inside the ice as it forms. Well, that hexagon shape represents space in between the molecules. So if you're creating these spaces because the water molecules are pulling themselves apart, that means you're making something that is less dense, which is why water expands when it freezes. This is a special property of water because it is so polar. Now, related to this, what is the shape of a snowflake? If you look at snowflakes, if you look at pictures of them online, they're all hexagon-like shapes, which is because what happens down at the molecular level, the fact that water forms these hexagonal patterns, that extends out to something larger like a snowflake, which, okay, a snowflake's a small thing, but compared to a water molecule, it's a huge thing. So what happens down at the molecular level can also affect what happens at the larger scale level. Here's another practical result of the fact that water is less dense when it freezes. It floats. You might say, okay, yeah, so what? Well, if it didn't do that, then there wouldn't be any sea life that would ever exist in any kind of lake where it freezes over. If you've ever lived in a cold environment, you know that the ice is going to form on the top because it floats. But that means that the water that's trapped underneath is still liquid, which means that life that's living down at the bottom of a lake like that can still exist because it's still liquid water. If ice were to sink when it freezes, that means it kills off anything underneath. So it's part of the special property of water that keeps sea life alive like that. This idea of polarity we could go on with. DNA, what makes us up? You might have heard before that DNA is this huge molecule that exists as two strands that are wrapped around. Well, those two strands are held together exactly by these same kind of polar attractions. It shows up all over the place in life. So polarity is something that actually does matter. Now, bringing the story back home, yes, water has bonds that are polar, but it's also got a bent shape. The lone pairs don't balance out the bonds, and so the bonds have no way of having their polarity cancel. And that's why water is so polar. It's got polar bonds, and its shape doesn't cancel that polarity out. So let me write that little bit that I just said here. Besides the fact that the bonds in water are polar, the shape, I almost said the shape of water, but that's a movie, isn't it? The shape is not symmetric. It's bent. So the polarity of the bonds does not cancel out. So the molecule is polar. The other shape that's polar because of its shape is trigonal pyramidal. Ammonia is also polar. It's got three of the same kind of bonds, but they don't lie flat. That's the big difference between something that's trigonal planar, that's flat, and something like this that's a pyramid. Yeah, part of it cancels out, but and the parts that are extending out in the three directions, but it's a three-dimensional object. It's a pyramid. And so from top to bottom, it doesn't cancel out. So ammonia is also polar because its shape is not symmetric. To express it a slightly different way, the lone pair does not cancel out the polarity. Yes.
So is the lone pair always the key for polar or not polar?
For all the shapes you're going to learn, yes. In some of the more advanced shapes, you end up with enough lone pairs that the lone pairs end up balanced out. And so it is possible to have lone pairs and be nonpolar. But in the five shapes you've learned, that yes, if you have a lone pair, that automatically makes it polar. The other reason you would end up with something polar is in a molecule like this. So this is hydrogen cyanide. And I should point out that single bonds, double bonds, triple bonds, we count them all the same when determining shape. So even though this has a triple bond in it versus a single bond, this shape is linear. So let me write this down. So the shape of HCN is linear. Single, double, and triple bonds are all counted the same. And I just said earlier that if you had something linear, you could have those different sides of the molecule cancel each other out. But that was in a case where we had the same atom on both sides. Well, now we've got a hydrogen on one end, nitrogen on the other. One of them's a single bond, one of them's a triple bond. And so these two things don't cancel each other out. So that's the other way that you can end up with a polar molecule, which even if the shape itself would normally be symmetric, if you have different atoms on the outside, then that could cause it where it doesn't cancel out, and that could make it polar. So even though it's linear, HCN is polar because it has two different bonds. And that's the end of chapter 4, which that's the end of the material that's on the exam, other than just a tiny bit from chapter 3 that I skipped over. So I want to back up to chapter 3, and then I'll do the review for the exam. So in chapter 3, that was the chapter on periodic table and on electron configurations. Now, the beginning of chapter 3 had those different experiments that explain where atomic theory came from. At this point, we're not going to go back and cover them right before the exam, so you could still skip over those sections in terms of the exam. It's only going to be whatever part of chapter 3 we covered, which we'll review that in just a moment here. But there's a little bit at the end of the chapter related to the periodic table that I didn't get to. And that's the part I'd like to talk about just briefly here. So there's different rows and different columns on the periodic table. And instead of just calling them rows and columns, they have terms that go with them. So a period is a row on the periodic table. And why is it called periodic? Because the behaviors of the atoms repeat as you go from row to row to row. And that's seen in the different columns of atoms, which are called groups. So group is a column on the periodic table. Some of the groups have names. And there's two names I'd like you to know because the names come up often enough in chemical discussions that that's the only reason I would make you memorize these types of things. I already used one of the names before, and that's for the last column, and those are known as the noble gases. So they include things like neon, helium, argon, and they're called noble because they don't normally react. The other name that I want you to know are the halogens. Halogens, those include things like fluorine, chlorine, bromine. Halos is a Greek word meaning salt. Gen, like generate, to make. So these are salt makers. They're the elements that form in seawater and table salt. Or not form, but they're found in seawater and table salt. Yes?
So why would the noble gases, if they don't, if they're normally non-reactive, why would they be put next to the most electronegative elements on the periodic table?
Because it has to do with how many valence electrons there are. So that, in fact, that was what I was going to do as a little bit of review. If we look at fluorine, if we look at its electron configuration, it ends up being 1s2, 2s2, 2p5. If we look at the next element down, it's 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s2, 3p5. For the exam, you're still only responsible for being able to go up to argon, element 18, as far as doing your electron configurations. But I'm going to go ahead and write out the one for bromine just to be able to talk about it. It's 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s2, 3p6, 4s2, 3d10, 4p5. Now, what are valence electrons? The ones that are the outermost shell. So if I underline the valence electrons in fluorine, it's all the ones in the 2 level. If I underline the valence electrons in chlorine, it's all the ones in the 3 level. And even though it skips over a bit, if I underline in bromine, it's all the ones in the 4 level. Well, all of the halogens have the same valence electrons. They all have 7 valence electrons, which is why they all tend to make negative 1 charges, which is why they're all considered part of the same group. So halogens, if you do the same, or not halogens, the noble gases, they all have 8 valence electrons. That's why they're right next door, but that's why they end up non-reactive, because they have 8, because they follow this octet rule. And what makes the halogens so reactive is they're so close to being octets. So hopefully that answers your question. Okay, so, but back to this idea of periods. Periodic means the behavior repeats. And the behavior repeats because each time you come to the same element in the same column, they have the same number of valence electrons. So halogens all have similar chemical behavior. Because they have the same number of valence electrons. And that's true for the other columns as well. I'm just not going to make you memorize the other columns' names. So that was the little bit of chapter 3 that I hadn't gone over yet. So now, do the review for the exam. So it will include the topics from quiz number 1, which, since we're running a little over on time, we already reviewed the topics for quiz 1 in one of the previous lectures. So what I'll do is I'll look up which lecture day that was so that you can go back to the notes. I think that was on... Yes, so that was on the 16th. So at the end of the notes on the 16th, it lists the topics from chapters 1, 2, and 3. So from chapter 3 specifically, I'm going to say no experiments, meaning that the gold foil experiment, the Bohr model, all of those ideas that led to the structure of the atom, I'm going to leave that off the exam. The Bohr model is important. I did just describe it earlier when we went over the quiz answers, but it's a complicated enough concept. I would like to be able to talk about it again sometime before I put it into some type of test question. So that means that we're going to leave out sections 1, 2, and 3 still, and we're going to leave out section 4 as well, because that was the gold foiled experiment. But then getting into section 5, some of this was already what was on the quiz. So I'm only not writing this down because it was part of quiz review. That you still need to know what isotopes are. You still need to know what the atomic number versus the mass number is. But the thing that wasn't on the quiz, that maybe I had reviewed it, but I left it off on purpose, you do need to know how to do electron configurations. And again, you only need to worry about going up through argon at the moment. Maybe later on, we'll get around to doing some of the later configurations. So that means you do need to know what shells and subshells are, as well as, in general, what orbitals are. Since we just reviewed it, I'll say that you do need to know what periods and groups are. That periods are the rows in the periodic table, and that the groups are the columns, the elements that have similar behavior because of the number of valence electrons that they have. And for groups, remember I just said that there's two of them you need to know specifically. Those are the halogens and the noble gases. So there's good chunks of chapter 3 that are not on the exam, but the most important part, which may be the most complicated part, is the electron configurations. Now moving on to chapter 4. So sections... Is there? The parts of 3.6 that deal with electron configuration, same with 3.7, and then 3.8. So it's 3.5 through 3.8, leaving out the Bohr model of the atom. Now, chapter 4. It's going to be pretty much the whole chapter. Let me just flip through it really quickly to make sure that's a true statement. So yes, it's chapter 4, all sections. So some of the things that we discussed, being able to figure out what charge an ion is normally going to form. Remember, that's directly tied to electron configuration and directly tied to the octet rule, the idea that atoms are most favorable when they've got 8 electrons in their outer shell. So looking at the first column with lithium and sodium, those make plus 1 ions because they only have one valence electron. Beryllium, magnesium, calcium, they make plus 2 ions because they only have 2 valence electrons. Other side of the periodic table, the halogens are negative 1 because they're only 1 electron away from being an octet. And so that is one of the big important concepts in the chapter, particularly section 4. So the octet rule is in section 4.4, and figuring out ion charges, that's also mainly section 4.4. Then we get naming compounds with monatomic ions. That's in section 4.5. And remember, the main principle there is that we always balance out charge. So calcium, for example, is a plus 2 ion. Chlorine is a negative 1 ion. So if we wanted to write the formula out for calcium chloride, we need 2 chlorines to go with each calcium. So we had done some practice in class learning how to put ion names together, and if you haven't been doing homework problems, the one area besides electron configuration you need to make sure you practice is in doing naming of compounds. Now, electronegativity. That's come up in 2 different places now. And electronegativity, that's in section 4.7. That's how hard that an atom pulls on electrons that are in a bond. So one reason for learning about electronegativity is it tells us whether we're going to have an ionic versus covalent bond. And remember, in ionic bonds, that difference is so big that electrons are effectively transferred. And then the ions stick together just because of their charges. For covalent bonds, the electronegativity difference is smaller. And so the atoms end up sharing the electrons. That's how we get the 2 different types of bonds. Now, to help you all out a little bit, because you had maybe a rough time on the first quiz, you're not going to have to worry about naming covalent compounds. So the part that has mono, di, tri, all of that, you can ignore worrying about those kinds of names. Because on the flip side, you do need to worry about polyatomic ions. Which, that's the one area where I'm really insistent about naming, because we use them so much throughout all the rest of the quarter. Anytime we refer to a compound name, it's going to have things like nitrate or sulfate or hydroxide in it. So you've just got to get over that barrier and learn those ion names. So you need to know their names, you need to know their formulas, you need to know their charges, and only the ones that are in your text. So I had written most of those in the notes in the class the other day. You've got Lewis dot structures, which we did several examples of in class. Remember, some of the rules involve figuring out how many valence electrons you've got. You have to know how the atoms are arranged. So either I have to give that to you, or remember that for most of the substances, it's the first atom that's in the middle and the rest go around the outside. The last 2 topics of the chapter, Vesper theory. That's the one about shapes. And then we just talked about molecular polarity. So there may be a little more emphasis on chapter 4 in the exam, since that's got more of the new material. But you do still need to know the material from the previous sections as well. For those of you who can't make my office hours at 1:30, I'll stick around for a few minutes here. And then otherwise, I do have office hours at 1:30 today.